community projects with Gina Furman, with the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs presenting, as well as a discussion of the Psychiatric Security Review Board with Mayor Claire Buckley presenting, and then a presentation on a co-management project with Mike Morris, Extended Care with Delia Cruz and Oregon Psychiatric Inpatient Care. And we're going to add somebody to that panel aside from Dr. May. So I'd like to invite Gina Furman forward.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I may, behind your agenda for materials today, you have a paper clipped or a clipped packet that says OSHA fact sheet. This was provided by Mary Bodkin. This is just additional information as follow-up from our Wednesday evening hearing for your information. And also, I do understand that the Governor's Mental Health Task Force report was delivered to all the members. I do have extra copies for some reason if members wish an extra copy or have misplaced their original here. Just let me know and I'll give you that copy, but I don't want to overwhelm you with so much paper if you already have it.
Trade you for this one.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Chair Dalto, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Furman. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And you'll forgive me, I usually don't like to read the testimony into the record, but this is good stuff and I don't want to miss any of it. Counties, as you know, are the critical community discharge resource. State hospital patients that are ready for discharge are connected with local community mental health programs to provide mental health and addiction services available directly through counties or to a private provider under contract with counties. In addition to facilitating discharges from the state hospital, counties are able to divert about 7,000 Oregonians a year from civil commitment to the state hospital to other community resources and services. These are Oregonians that are believed to be dangerous to self or others or unable to care for their basic needs because of their mental illness. Counties provide a wide range of treatment services and supports, including safe and affordable housing. As you know, it's been testified to before, counties have helped create $75 million worth of affordable housing. Counties provide oversight of most residential programs and help provide consultation and training for providers. Some counties have geropsychiatric specialists who work with the county's geropsych or the state hospital's geropsych program, as well as nursing homes, in order to keep older adults in the least restrictive settings possible. Counties are working closely with the state to reach an agreement on contractual language that would formalize the relationship for co-management of patients ready for discharge, and Mike Morris will be talking about that more later. Counties are also actively involved with twice monthly meetings with State Hospital and OMAS, that's Oregon Mental Health and Addiction Services. I don't want to have to pay any fines.
None here.
Good.
We can keep up.
The managers to routinely identify better opportunities to better integrate state hospital and community services.
Smart guy.
Counties have a number of projects to help with lowering admissions to the Oregon State Hospital and for helping patients return to their communities. And I want to go over just a few of these with you. Deschutes, Washington, and Lincoln counties receive about $60,000 a year from federal block grant money to interface between jails, community corrections, and community mental health programs. In Deschutes County, their mental health specialist works in the jail and helps individuals access appropriate treatment and supports. We believe these programs are of great value in integrating care for a particularly vulnerable population, but you'll notice they're only in three counties. Mid Valley Behavioral Care Network, the regional mental health organization, I want to make sure that you know we're doing things regionally, that serves Lynn, Marion, Polk, Yamhill, and Tillamook counties, has a project called EAST, that's Early Assessment and Supportment Team, to provide early intervention to those adults age 18 to 25 that are struggling with major mental illness using innovative models of medication management and wraparound services and supports. Deschutes, Josephine, and Coos counties have model crisis resolution centers to triage patients and get them to alternatives other than the state hospital, if possible. local acute care units, residential group homes, and intensive case management help to keep citizens in their community of choice. In Josephine County, the Crisis Resolution Center diverted 193 individuals from hospital during the year 2003-2004 at a cost of about $350 per day for an average of 3 days versus acute hospitalization of $750 per day or more. While these are examples of projects and collaborations that exemplify what community mental health programs would like to provide and do provide, there are barriers to more effectively serving the state hospital population. Here is what is not working well. There is little non-Medicaid money to help the working poor or inadequately insured, despite the fact that non-Medicaid enrolled individuals account for nearly half of all state hospital patients at admission. Counties struggle to provide a wide breadth of wraparound services, step-down services, and supports on limited budgets. Even though we have created several housing projects, it is estimated that there is still a need for about 14,000 more units for people with chronically and persistent mental illness. Limited resources and local siting requirements lengthen the time it takes to create an adequate number of community and regional alternatives. Due to the limited number of acute care psychiatric beds and inadequate numbers of appropriate community housing placement, wait lists are long. As a result of limited options, both individuals in need of greater support and those who are ready for discharge from the state hospital suffer because they stay there longer. Jail, prison, and forensic populations are growing, and there is limited capacity to provide mental health and addiction treatment services in appropriate settings. Without additional state general fund to serve this population for whom Medicaid benefits are suspended, transition planning and appropriate treatment and supports are problematic. Transportation to and from the state hospital, especially from rural areas, takes law enforcement officers off the road for extended periods of time and causes frustration with the system. Extended care management unit staff and county staff have caseload demands that make it very difficult to get patients out of the state hospital in a timely manner. In addition, the limited alternative placement settings in the community adds to the difficulties of managing these large workloads. With Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center slated to close half of its beds on October 1, 2005, Eastern Oregon loses its capacity to attend to an acute care needs and must spend time and resources to find other alternatives that are not yet built. We know what to do, and we know how to wrap services and supports around clients to provide effective care. What we need is stable and adequate funding of a whole system of care. Many of our counties have worked hard to create pieces of the system that are working very well. We appreciate your interest in learning more about the Oregon State Hospital and how the system works. Counties look forward to working with you, OMHOS, state hospital staff, our customers, and other partners to create the mental health system of care that Oregon truly deserves. Thank you. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Jean. Any questions? There's an agreement.
You know, I'm going to soon be in an area in which I don't know what I'm talking about, but maybe you can help me. I think you know I've worked with a group of substance abuse providers statewide in trying to improve treatment and research in that area. And some of them feel that there's some state contracts that they can't bid on, that only counties can bid on as the primary bidders. And they'd like to be able to, some of them at least would like to be able to bid to provide the countywide services, at least in the substance abuse area or substance abuse and mental health. Can you help me with what that situation is? And I mean,
sure, Chair Dalzell, Representative Greenhawk, I'd be glad to. There is only one county, that's Douglas County, that actually has a direct contract from the state. I think what you're talking about is that counties are the local mental health authority, and so those contracts come through the counties, and then the counties or the communities get to decide who gets to bid on them. Counties officials are elected, they're bonded, they're audited, and the thing that we are that we most support is that counties, they have, sorry, distracted by the phone. It's probably mine. they are accountable. So we don't have any problem with private providers bidding on contracts as long as they go through the county. And so that, I think, is what you're going to have to decide when you have counties directly from the state. They bypass the whole county system, which is your local mental health authorities.
Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about this independently.
Sure.
And I know a little better what I'm talking about. Thank you, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair.
Thank you. I'd be glad to talk with you further.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gina, Deschutes, Washington, and Lincoln County have federal block grant subsidy to do some interface mm-hmm. with their mental health issues. Douglas, Josephine, and Coos have modeled resolution centers. I guess the concern that I would have relative to these issues would be how many of these, how much local funds are going into these, and how do these counties support these locally funded programs? And then what's the issue with Douglas County that it contracts directly with the state? Is the state in a better position to do some of this work than the counties have been able to do?
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, you asked a number of questions there. One is that the federal block grant money that comes to those three counties, that is just something decided to do to see if it works. It seems to be working very well. The community block grant dollars are one that I think the state and the counties work very well with. We're trying out new things and to see what works, and then hopefully we can do more of those. The crisis resolution centers basically are a mix of fund. They're a mix of state fund, local funds, and also private provider funds. A lot of times the counties or a private hospital will give the money for the land, and it is really a braided funding that pays for it. It really works quite well. As far as Douglas County and the state contracting mm-hmm. directly, the counties have the first right of refusal, and the Douglas County commissioners chose to give up their right and gave the provider in Douglas County the right to bid on that first. That's something the county commissioners chose a few boards back.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may be a little bit out of sync, but I'm thinking about some of the testimony we heard the other night in terms of security, and you're talking about closing beds in Eastern Oregon and we're opening a new prison eventually. And it seems to me that I'm wondering if there wouldn't be some way in which we can have more of a mental health, mental therapy wing of a new prison where there is security, mm-hmm. where there would be a chance to call those patients who are really mentally ill and not necessarily pathological criminal, and treat them there at the prison. Is that in the plan at all in terms of looking at the large picture?
Chair Dalton, Representative Anderson, I spent an hour yesterday on the phone with some representatives from KMD Architects that are taking a look at this, and they've hired some mental health staff. I think that's absolutely a possibility. I think they're going to be very, very thorough and present us with some options the middle of May that all of you will be really proud of. They are doing their homework, and I know that that's one of the options under consideration.
Good.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gene, on the second page of your testimony, you talk about a little non-Medicaid money to help the working poor. And despite the fact that non-Medicaid individuals make up nearly half of all state hospital patients at admission, is there anything that we can do to facilitate getting more Medicaid monies for these folks?
Representative Dalto, Representative Tomei, excuse me, did you say get more Medicaid money?
Correct.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that you should remember is we do need the state hospital, absolutely. How many beds? We're trying to discover that. But one of the things that we can do by moving some of the people that can be in communities with 16-bed or less facilities, we can access more Medicaid money. It's a 60-40 match. We can get 60% Medicaid money.
It seems sort of a, if I may follow up, thank you, chicken or egg. We can't move people out of the hospital because there are no community facilities for them, and finding the community or the money to build those facilities mm-hmm. is a problem. If we had them, then some of these folks could go there and we could get Medicaid money for them. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
So do you have any ideas where we step in here to help provide the funding for those services, those facilities, so that we can move some of these folks out of the hospital?
Representative Dalto and Representative Tomei, I think it's kind of like a jigsaw puzzle. Like you said, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Through the state hospital master planning, what I'm hoping that will come of it is a plan where we can start moving in that direction one step at a time. We know that the budget is tight and there's not a lot of money, but I think there's several things that we could do. For instance, we could start some pilot projects. For $15 million, we could do five crisis resolution centers regionally around the area. That's just something that we can start on. We can put East projects in other MHOs. I think there are little things that we can start doing little by little to help with this, but it is going to take several years to implement this because there is no magic bullet. There is no magic big pot of money to start moving. So you can't just close down a hospital ward without some transition funds and some carefully, thoughtful processes about where you move employees, where you move patients. So I would like to say there's a pot of money there that we could start with, but I think it's the legislature deciding which pieces to start first.
Thank you, Gina. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, thank you. Gina, is there a special enhancement to the Medicaid match for a population like this? You know, just sort of thinking along the lines of the education arena where you get a special match for students in certain categories, and I'm wondering if there's anything like that you know of in Medicaid funding.
Representative Dalto, not as you're suggesting at this time. No, that's okay. Go ahead.
Could you repeat your answer?
Not as you're suggesting at this time. I don't know of any special pots of money that could be used as match for Medicaid. However, I do know that, and as you know, the federal government is working on a number of issues right now to figure out how their Medicaid system is going to look. And I believe that our Senator Gordon Smith has some options that he's thinking about. We'll see what comes out in the works.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
There is a match in the sense of the children's mental health, the children's health insurance program, which is a 25%, 75% match. The extent to which we could get children's mental health and get kids covered under CHIP and get mental health covered under that, that is a match. We've been worrying about the cost of adolescent health care, adolescent mental health services, and that might be a place where we could look to, in fact, to help this.
Okay.
Can I ask one more question?
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. Gene, we also, when people go to the jail or prison or whatever, they lose their Medicaid benefits, correct?
Correct.
And so that's one of the problems that we have. Is there any way that we can help change that?
Representative Dalto, Representative Tomei, yes, as a matter of fact, there is a bill floating around, and I'll have to chase down the number because I don't know if it's through the pipeline yet, to help take a look at suspending benefits rather than cutting them off altogether, because once they're cut off, it's a lot more difficult to get them reinstated, and it takes time. So the hospital or the jails, give the person medications, and then they can't access those medications for a couple, 3 weeks, and they're usually back in jail. So it would be very helpful to get a law like that passed. Basildon Law Center has a model law. If we passed one like that, that would be very helpful.
Pull it. So that we could do that within the state. It doesn't have to get a federal
That is correct.
Grant to do that. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the problems of volunteerism, but are there programs that you're doing at this point in time where volunteers can extend the benefits of the paid professionals? Are there areas where we can have retired volunteers or people that do have time that would be willing to volunteer their services at minimum wage or tax credit or something that they could be brought in to give legs to the people who are really the key personnel that need to be there in the department doing the organizational work?
Sure, Chair Dalto.
And does federal money fit in there, either on a faith-based or other areas?
Chair Dalto, Representative Anderson, there's a number of programs. One of the things that we're up against is HIPAA compliance and confidentiality. And so once people are run through that, the other thing, as you probably know, there is a bill up this session to help cut through some of those red tapes for retired physicians and other personnel that want to retire. We also, in the mental health system, we have several drop-in centers where patients that are in recovery themselves help out and volunteer, and that has been very, very successful. So, yes, there's a number of things that we are doing and can be doing further.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, Gina, thanks very much. Bob Junta is not on the agenda, but... Oh, Bob Nickel, excuse me. Bob Nickel had a couple of comments to make. We had a technical name issue.
N-I.
Mr. Chair,
Bob Junedep is going to come up as well, but later in the program. So, Bob Nickel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Thanks for giving me an opportunity. I want to clarify that in the governor's recommended budget, there is a factor that's built in for the growth that happens and that we predict will happen in mandated clients. These are civilly committed and criminally committed patients. And the calculations that we have currently indicate that we will be able to create about 274 additional community placements using Medicaid. So I wanted to add to what Gina Furman testified, that there actually is an opportunity in the governor's recommended budget to continue to tap into more Medicaid in order to create the kind of community resources to keep the population of the state hospital moving when they're ready to get out of the hospital. So I appreciate the opportunity just to clarify that point.
Can we talk about that point for just a moment? Do we know how many people are in the state hospital right now that have completed their treatment, they're ready to return to the community, but there aren't placements for them, so they're sort of awaiting release?
Mr. Chair, the estimates vary, but maybe Mary Claire Buckley can provide a little bit more detail on the PSRB population. I understand there are about 40 PSRB patients who have been approved for a conditional release pending an actual place for them to move. In addition to that, I think you heard testimony on Monday that at any given time there are probably 150 patients at Oregon State Hospital who are in active discharge planning. Now, not all of that 150 are today ready for discharge, but the estimates really vary between, you know, that 40 number and maybe as many as 100. But again, having the community placements available when the patient is ready is very critical, because the patient may be ready to be discharged, but if a place isn't there for them that day or that week, that sets them back, frankly, clinically, because they feel that they've done the work clinically and their treatment plan, and it's discouraging, and sometimes then they relapse some, or there's some of the old behaviors creep back in the institutional setting.
And Bob, I'm still confused about a couple of things here. The 40 PSRB patients that are ready to go, is one set of folks, and then you described another set of folks which are in the active process of their discharge. They're in the process of having their discharges planned. Why are those folks separate?
Mr. Chair, I was including both criminally committed, those are essentially the PSRB clients, along with civilly committed patients. And as you heard, we have different hospital units that serve the criminally committed population versus those that serve the civilly committed patients. And some of the patients that I included in the number are out at Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center. The estimates there is that 20 to 30 of those patients of the 60 may be ready for discharge very soon.
So the PSRB patients are strictly criminally committed patients?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And that's the same as forensic patients?
That's correct.
Okay, so there are no people under civil commitment that are under the responsibility of PSRB?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. So who makes the determination of the civil commitments?
Mr. Chair, that's a determination that's made jointly between the state hospital and the community programs.
Okay. Questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, I'm, for lack of a better person at this particular time, to ask this question, and the question keeps coming up in my mind, that is with regard to the Eastern Oregon facility. My concern is that facility used to house hundreds of people. Now we're down to something like 60 or 80 people, and talking about a complete closure of it. Number one, what's going to happen to the facility? Number two, what are the people that are there, and finally, what are we going to do for those civil commitments or other transitory commitments that we've got in Eastern Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, those are very good questions. We're going to be obviously talking about those, I'm sure, in much greater detail in the Ways and Means discussion. The plan right now is for 30 beds to close at Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center if the governor's recommended budget is passed. And I believe the date is November of 06. So we have the period between now and then to begin putting together discharge plans for at least 30 of those patients. That will cut into the caseload growth money that we have for civilly committed patients, but some of that 275 additional beds that I mentioned earlier would almost certainly need to be available to help with the placement of at least some of the 30 patients. At that point, we would be operating a 30-bed hospital. There is not a proposal in the governor's recommended budget to close Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center, so we will have 30 beds left there. There are questions about how we handle the acute care business, and we've called a meeting for next Friday with the Eastern Oregon mental health directors and a few other people to talk about how we're going to operate with a 30-bed hospital, how we're going to deal with acute care, because there's another change in the federal regulations that will cut down on the number of Medicaid payments that we currently have under a waiver with the federal government for acute care patients, that is those patients who stay 30 days or less. So we're starting that planning process in earnest next week, Friday, out in Boardman.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Bob, as I look down the committee here, there's not a lot of us sitting on this committee from Eastern Oregon, but when you've had the meeting next week with those folks, not necessarily our committee, but I'd like to have some response back as to what their feel is as to how they're going to respond to just about any way you slice it. It's an 8-hour trip, and if it has to be 2 to 3 people that are making that trip to escort somebody out of Eastern Oregon, it's just I mean it becomes a security issue for everyone involved. It becomes a very delicate situation. I'm anxious for my mental health workers in Eastern Oregon. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I'd be happy to get your report. And I think these are the very questions that we need to be asking. I can tell you that one of the ideas that's come up is to try to develop something that might look like the facility that just opened in February in Deschutes County called Sageview, which is a 15-bed Medicare, 16-bed Medicaid-eligible program that does combination of acute care things. So I think there are ideas that have already been put on the top of the table, but we need to have a good discussion about it, and I'll be happy to get back to you on it.
Thank you.
Bob, is there a plan in the Ways and Means process that you're aware of to try to buy back those 30 additional beds? I mean, are people discussing that? Have they requested the information of you?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think those are the questions that are going to be coming up. I don't know if anybody has specifically requested that yet, but I think, you know, the governor proposes and the legislature disposes, and I think that's the discussion we'll be having in that process.
You know, one thing, by the way, as a side note, I think we might like to see is if we could have a list of the people that you're serving that are serve eligible for Medicaid to get a sense of the numbers, how many are benefiting from Medicaid, because as I reflect on the discussion that we had about in a previous question but also in previous committee hearings about trying to keep people from losing their OHP benefits if they get incarcerated or things like that. I mean, I'd love to know how many people we're really talking about and what OHP benefit they have in their particular benefit.
Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to. I can't provide names, of course, but I can provide the numbers. We're actually doing that fiscal analysis right now, and I believe the bill that Gina Furman mentioned is Senate Bill 913, and we're looking at the fiscal impact. There will be a fiscal impact from it, because anytime there's a delay in eligibility, it saves the state that general fund match. The problem is that these people then are without the kind of benefits that they need to have in order to keep on their medications. So I anticipate that there will be a budget impact on the OMAP budget.
Okay. Representative Greenlee and then Representative Tomei.
Thank you. First, Representative Butler as well, but I want to assure him we all care about what happens to mental health services in Eastern Oregon as well. Bob, I'd like to follow along the line Representative Tomei was on. You and I talked about the 16-bed facilities, I guess 15-bed facilities. What are the major barriers to those? Is it capital financing the barrier to get them started? Is it organizational interest? Why aren't there 100 more of them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwick, there are several barriers. One is the capital to construct these facilities. We often are able to help with that through our Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services Housing Acquisition Fund. So we do have some ability to help with that, but people have to put together fairly complex financing packages just to build it. There is a staff cost and time there. Frankly, we give the county mental health programs a very inadequate amount of local administration, and many of them do this, I know, working way beyond the normal hours. So staff time, both at the county level and at our level and at the provider level, are barriers. Sometimes, in spite of that, we've done a lot of it, but those are limiting factors. Occasionally, although not always, neighborhood concerns come up. And I think that those are probably the main factors. There is interest out there in developing these projects. Every time we put out a request for proposals to ask for organizations, counties, or nonprofits to help us develop these facilities, we're overwhelmed with applications. So it's not for lack of interest, and we have the ability to do it. I think it's really a matter of the resources to construct and operate the facilities, the development time that it takes to do these, and then working through the local issues, whether that's zoning or neighborhood resistance or whatever it might be.
Right. Brief follow-up, sir. How many of these do we have in place now around the state, and how many do you think we would need to serve the kind of...
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, we will have created about 250 new beds in communities. They're not just this biennium. We created about 200 the biennium before that. We're now at the point where we have, I think by the end of this biennium, about 800 alternative beds that we have created. Now, I think, as I've said before, nobody seems to know about these things because they work really well. Do we need more? Yes. I think it's clear we're going to need to create every one of those projected 274 beds that are in the governor's recommended budget just to keep up with the growing demand on the state hospitals. How many more in addition to that we need will be something we'll look at in the Oregon State Hospital master planning process. Some of that depends on the size of a state hospital that we would want to operate in the future. So I can't give you an exact number right now. I think we'll have a better idea of that in May, and then hopefully we'll have the Phase 2 planning process, which is also in the governor's recommended budget, which will give us a much more detailed picture of the...
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Representative Greenlee asked my question, but also I guess I'm wanting to follow up. further. So at the state hospital in Eastern Oregon, there will be 30 beds left, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, that's correct. And the governor's recommendation.
So maybe there's really, I'm just trying to get my brain around this. So why wouldn't it be appropriate to have only 16 patients there so we could get federal money, and that would mean 14 would go somewhere else where we could also get federal Medicaid money?
Representative Tomei, I'm sure that'll be one of the options that we'll look at. It would be that facility really has capacity for more than 60 beds, and to operate 16 I don't think would be very efficient in that particular plant, you know, all of the heating and all of the other things that go into that size of a building. But you know, I know that's something that we've at least thought about, and we'll probably talk about it next week.
So if I can follow up. So is that something that we're going to be working toward in the future rather than having larger hospitals, because then we can't get any Medicaid money for this, to have smaller facilities but have lots of them? Does that make sense, or does it make sense to have a larger facility?
Madam Vice Chair, Representative Tomei, I think, again, I'm not trying to punt on this one. I think that's the nature of the discussion we're going to have with the Oregon State Hospital Master Planning Process. I think that we will always need a fairly large, and I don't know what the size of that would be, central state hospital. But I think there are concepts where we might have, in a sense, 16-bed satellite facilities, maybe very close in proximity to, say, a 400 or 500-bed state hospital, which allows patients to be transitioned quickly, more quickly than they might have been able to tap into Medicaid. I think some of these could and should be state-operated. That's a new direction for mental health, right, though not for developmental disabilities. So all of those things are the things that are on the table for discussion.
Okay. Thanks, Bob. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Any additional questions?
Okay. I just like to point out that we're also worried about the changes in Medicaid. So if we end up with a Medicaid block grant, as is being proposed, then this whole thing may go off in a different direction.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwick, if you could indulge me, too. One of the issues that we're facing right now is all of the block grant for mental health is not very large. The alcohol and drug block grant is much larger as a proportion. We are in difficulty because of cuts in the budgets for mental health and addictions in the last 2 to 3 years. We have a waiver request pending. We hope that they will find us in material compliance, but it's on the desk of the new Secretary of Health and Human Services in Washington, D.C., and it is not a foregone conclusion that they're going to approve our material compliance request, and we could be paying a penalty in both the mental health and the addictions block grant, and that would not help our cause at all.
Mr. Chair, if I may, that's because we haven't fulfilled the maintenance of effort. We haven't kept our end of the bargain to meet the block grant assessment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, we have not met the financial maintenance of effort requirements, but they allowed us an opportunity to request what's called material compliance, and we have given them a great deal of data over the last year to show that we have not cut substantially the services that people have actually accessed, and they have been very helpful to us in helping us provide information, but we don't know yet what the answer is going to be.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, thanks, Bob. All right, next we're going to hear from Mary Claire Buckley, who's the director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Maybe clarify some of the questions that we all have. So, good morning, welcome.
Good morning. Welcome, Chair Dalto, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the executive director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. I thank you for the invitation to appear this morning. I know that on Monday and Wednesday you have heard quite a bit about the board and particularly its clients, but the board appreciates the opportunity to speak directly with you about its operations and its role in the forensic system and how it interrelates with the other players. My understanding is that you wish me to focus on the board's relationship with the hospital, the conditional release process, and the revocation process, which I'd be happy to do. But before I get to that, I, like Barry Cass, think that a brief historical review would be helpful to gain some perspective as to how and why the system is set up as it is. However, due to time limitations, I will assure you that I only am going to look back 30 years rather than 150. The Psychiatric Security Review Board is the state agency that assumes jurisdiction over all those persons found guilty except for a crime by a judge or jury who may pose a substantial danger to others. It was created by the 1977 legislature as a unique experiment, the first of its kind in this nation, for the management and treatment of insanity acquittees. Prior to that time, the system for the disposition of insanity acquittees was vastly different. Individual judges maintained jurisdiction over these clients who had successfully asserted that defense in their courtrooms. Once that finding was made, the statutes required the judges to decide if the individual should be committed to the state hospital for an indeterminate sentence. If so, then the judge continued to be responsible for these individuals and in deciding when to release them to the community. The reality of that meant that when the hospital staff thought the individual was ready for conditional release or discharge, it would petition the court for a hearing. However, the judges had very limited opportunity to monitor the person's progress in the hospital, as there was little communication or collaboration between the two entities. So courts often just deferred to the recommendations of the hospital staff. Without the necessary funds or staffing, judges were unable to create effective conditional release plans, to monitor the person's performance in the hospital, or return them to the hospital if his mental health deteriorated, rendering him dangerous. Later, when the board was created and we were to assume responsibility for these people who had previously been found guilty except for insanity, it was found that the courts had lost track of many of these individuals in the community under their jurisdiction. The result was no supervision and risk to the community. At the same time, the mental health division was faced with a growing number of insanity clients and increasingly overcrowded forensic wards, much as we have today. Perhaps as a result of these pressures, many individuals were released from the hospital after very brief stays. Although there are no statistics currently available, the public perceived that these early releasees went out and reoffended. There was widespread concern that this system did little or nothing to assure community safety. And members, therein lies the reason the PSRB was created. Because as a response to those general concerns, two separate task forces were created in the mid-70s, one in corrections and one in mental health, that both concurred with the public's view that this procedure was not effective or safe. Thus, the board was born of a desire to fix this problem. It was established as a separate state agency, independent of the mental health and criminal justice systems, but designed to work closely with both, with responsibility for monitoring all those who successfully asserted the insanity defense who pose a danger. The legislature structured the agency to assure the board's autonomy in decision-making so that its determinations were based on both clinical and risk assessments of the client rather than any political or census considerations. It was set up and continues to be today a part-time five-member multidisciplinary board. Membership is comprised by statute of a psychiatrist and psychologist experienced in the criminal justice system, an attorney with criminal trial practice, a parole and probation officer, and a member of the general public. The enabling statutes in ORS Chapter 161 direct the board in several sections to have as its primary concern the protection of society. That is the job this legislature gave the board, and I submit to you that is the job the board is doing and doing well. That is evidenced by its extremely low recidivism rate over the years, which is 2% since the board began keeping performance measures in 1992, and is currently 1% for this biennium, as well as by the fact that the board is considered a national model for the management and treatment of these clients and has been cited so by various organizations, including the American Psychiatric Association and the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. And I have provided you with a packet of information, and the first article is something that was written when the board received the APA's 1994 Gold Achievement Award. The board has managed this task while being ever mindful of clients' rights and their need for appropriate care and treatment. Its mission is to protect the public through the ongoing review of the progress of persons found guilty except for insanity and a determination of their appropriate placement. The board's options for placement are commitment to a secure forensic ward at the state hospital, released to a highly structured and supervised program in the community on conditional release, or discharged from jurisdiction. In making these determinations, once again, the law requires that the board consider public safety first. It accomplishes this mission through both aspects of its programs, both hearings and the monitoring. Our clients are individuals who, by definition, suffer from a mental disease or defect, which, when active, can cause them to pose a substantial danger to others. They are placed under the board by a trial court. The length of jurisdiction is equal to the maximum sentence they could have received had they been found guilty. Sentencing guidelines do not apply. The court then makes the initial determination as to whether the individual should be committed directly to the state hospital or could be adequately treated and supervised in the community. Currently, about 75% of the board's new clients are sent directly from court to the state hospital. Thus, the board is inextricably linked with the hospital, as that is where its clients are committed for care and treatment. As you can see from this structure alone, the board was designed as a collaborative effort. It receives its clients from the criminal justice system and then relies on the hospital to provide the treatment needed in an inpatient facility, and then later on the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services to fund a plan that our community mental health partners develop and ultimately implement for our clients.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Representative.
Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mary Claire, but did I understand you to say that they cannot be committed to a mental health facility any longer than they would have been committed to a prison if they were found guilty without the...
Chidolto, Representative Tomei, that's correct. They get the maximum sentence that the statute would have provided. So, for example, a Class A felony, they're put under the board for 20 years, a B felony is 10, and a C felony is 5, and misdemeanors similarly. And then for persons put under for murder, that would be a life disposition.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I comment?
Representative Greenlee.
But they can, if they're in the state hospital at the time their sentence expires, be subject to a civil commitment proceedings at that time. Is that right?
Chiodolto, Representative Greenlee, yes. If they continue to meet that criteria for civil commitment, that can be continued.
Thank you.
The board and staff work very closely with Oregon State Hospital staff, including the psychiatrists, psychologists, and social workers, and others, to prepare for hearings and for the conditional release of its mutual clients. The board responds promptly to the hospital's request for hearings to obtain a conditional release for a client or for an order for community evaluation. There are currently 728 persons under the board's jurisdiction, and as you'll note on page one of the graphs that I gave you, the snapshot that we provided was as of March 15th, and in the meantime, in the past 3 days, I have two more clients. Most are indigent, as their only source of income was SSI or SSD prior to being hospitalized. Schizophrenia is the predominant diagnosis, and the vast majority of our clients have a history of alcohol or drug abuse as well. As you can see from that snapshot, about 96% of our clients are under the board for felony offenses, of which 75% of those involve serious person felonies such as assault, arson, and homicide. Statutes require that we provide hearings within certain time frames. The board hears testimony from hospital staff and others and receives exhibits and then makes its careful and deliberate decision. At each hearing, the board must decide whether the person continues to suffer from a mental disease or defect and whether he continues to pose a substantial danger to others when that illness is active. If so, the board maintains jurisdiction and then must make the further determination of whether the individual could be adequately controlled and treated in the community. If so, the process for conditional release planning and placement goes into higher gear. And by that I mean that obviously the hospital is working on conditional release almost from the time individuals are admitted. That's part of the process, is the goal is to ultimately get them. But once they have a hearing and the board makes that determination, then certain other avenues are sought by the board. It is true that the board exercises due caution in deciding who may be released. But this is not an arbitrary or unilateral decision. The board utilizes a comprehensive process, It begins with the treatment team's recommendation that a patient is ready for conditional release planning. After the client has completed the classes and groups and goals and objectives of their treatment plan, the board will then order a separate evaluation by a community mental health agency where parties agree that the patient could best be served. That agency then does a thorough independent assessment of their own to determine if they agree that the patient is ready for conditional release and if the community has the resources to adequately supervise and treat the client and they're willing to accept that responsibility. This is a critical piece of the process, as I'm sure Ms. Furman would tell you. County agencies are assuming liability when they accept our clients, so they must have the authority to accept or reject these individuals based on whether they have the appropriate treatment resources and fiscal resources, frankly. If so, it provides a plan that the patient and hospital must sign off on. Then there is a final review and approval of the conditions by the board. The board may tweak the plan that's been presented by requiring additional conditions such as more urinalysis testing than might have been suggested, additional AA or NA meetings per week, or other minor fixes, but I can tell you that it is a rare occurrence for the board to deny such a request. As you can see from the chart and materials, the board conditionally released a great number of individuals in 2004 alone. And that chart you will see on page 6 of the graphs, 107 individuals were conditional release by the board in calendar year 2004. As you can see, that's a substantial increase from 2002 and 2003, where 75 and 76 had been released. The other equally important aspect of the board is its monitoring function, which
I'm sorry,
is...
Sorry, but can I go on?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Go ahead. Ask the question.
Yeah, I'd like to ask... I'm really intrigued with the map on page 2, where 13 counties have no releases. Another 6 have 1 or 2 in their county. That's more than half of the counties with 0, 1, or 2. Only 3 counties have more than 17, but Malheur County has 17. What's going on in Malheur County?
Giudotto, Representative Greenlick, Malheur County has just developed a very good program for our clients, frankly. Lifeways Behavioral Health has stepped up to the plate and become a very critical partner with us and is willing to serve a number of our clients.
Mr. Chair, may I follow on that? I mean, I assume it's less expensive to have it done this way. Is there something we can learn from the Malheur County experience that we might... And there are... I mean, that 13 of the counties that have 0, for example, could learn. Is there something we can do to stimulate that or to help whatever's going on there?
Chair Dalton, Representative Gleenick, we are in the process of trying to solicit other, you know, communities to join this endeavor. I can tell you that a number of these counties, frankly, have not sent many clients to the board and also do not have the same resources that the larger counties have. You can see from this map that most of the clients are placed where the greatest number of resources are because our clients are in need of a substantial level of services. But yes, I will tell you that we are engaged in a large endeavor right now to get a number of these counties to step up to the plate.
Thank you, sir.
Could I ask a question? Thank you. I'd like to follow up on Representative Greenlick's earlier question. How many clients, or what proportion of clients, are civilly committed after they've served?
Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, I don't have that exact figure, and I would be, you know, happy to get that from you. That would, I'm sure the hospital could provide that. Once our jurisdiction ends, we have no more legal, you know, authority over them. So, but I would say it's a small percentage.
Small percentage. Okay, if I may follow up.
Bob, do you want to come up and do you have that information? Just go and get your answer.
Thanks.
Chair Dalton, members of the committee, I don't have the information with me, but I can get that for you. We can go into our database and get it. And I share Ms. Buckley's opinion. There's probably a very small number. For one thing, people are on the under the jurisdiction of the board for quite a long time, and probably by then they're pretty well stabilized. But we can get that information for you.
Can you just check in with your name?
Oh, I'm sorry, Bob Nickel.
Thank you, Bob.
Yeah, and I had that question too that Rep. Tomei just asked, a little bit different. How, I guess I wasn't listening carefully. They serve their sentence, their full sentence, or is there an opportunity to change it to a civil commitment? Is that right?
Chair Dalto, Representative, no, we don't switch it to a civil commitment. They are placed under the jurisdiction for a maximum period of time. The statute does allow a client to request an early termination if they no longer meet the legal criteria, which is that they either don't continue to have a mental disease or defect or don't pose a substantial danger to others. It would only be at their end of the jurisdiction and that when they still remain in the hospital that the determination is made whether they need to be civilly committed, continue that hospitalization.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and I'm not sure to whom this should go. But does it ever happen that someone has been sent to the forensic unit and you found out that they're not mentally ill, but they're a danger to society because of criminal behavior and probably would reoffend if they were to go back into society? And if so, what happens with those folks?
Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, that does happen on occasion. If after a period of time the hospital is of the opinion that the individual does not, who has been placed under the board's jurisdiction, no longer suffers from a mental disease or defect, the board, if it's proven by a preponderance of the evidence, then the board would have no choice under this statute but to outright discharge them from jurisdiction.
They wouldn't go to prison.
No.
They would be discharged. Okay.
Representative told me yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Would that happen with people who are being admitted for, I think a term we heard, meth psychoses?
Chair Dalto, that is one of the issues the board struggles with and has struggled with for years. Because I can assure you that anybody that comes under the board right now has at least, doesn't come under for just a substance abuse diagnosis or an alcohol abuse diagnosis. These individuals initially come to the board with some kind of psychotic disorder. It can be a brief reactive psychosis, it can be a methamphetamine-induced psychosis, substance-induced psychosis, the psychotic disorder, NOS, for example. But once they're in the hospital.
NOS?
Not otherwise.
Not, oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Not otherwise, that's funny.
You have to ask. Representative Greenlake, no.
But once that individual has been in the hospital for a while, has not had access to illicit substances, then, you know, that clears, and some individuals are just left with a substance abuse diagnosis. And then the board has to determine whether, in fact, that is or is not a mental disease or defect for purposes of the board's jurisdiction. I can tell you for years, the board struggled with that, and frankly, we had disparate decisions depending upon which panel was sitting on a particular day. However, this matter kept going to the Court of Appeals, and at one point we finally got a decision for the Court of Appeals that said, in fact, that substance abuse diagnoses, and I will tell you that I know you had a discussion the other night about Axis 1, Axis 2 diagnosis, but substance abuse diagnoses are Axis 1 diagnoses. They may not be considered major mental illnesses, but in our rule it says that a major mental illness, our mental disease or defect wasn't ever defined in the statute, and so our rules indicated that it was an Axis 1 diagnosis that could substantially impair the functioning in one area. And so they went to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals, in the case of Hansen, said, yes, it is a sufficient diagnosis for purposes of the board's jurisdiction. So we are bound by that law, and so the board at least became consistent in much, I'm sure, to the hospital's dismay, in keeping these individuals, because that was the law. Well, this matter continued to be appealed. And recently, a couple of years ago, we got another decision on this, and a separate, different panel of the Court of Appeals said it was not a sufficient diagnosis for board jurisdiction. So we had two on the same level, the Court of Appeals, with two different decisions, and we were advised by our counsel that we should petition the Supreme Court for review, given the two different opinions, and continue to maintain those individuals under our jurisdiction until a final word was received by the Supreme Court. That case was argued on January 5th of this year, and we await that determination by the Supreme Court.
This does sound like an interesting issue. I mean, you will have this person for, let's say, 112 months or something. The minimum sentence, the minimum they could possibly serve, might be much less than that. It would seem to me we might really want to consider a statute that would say if they're found guilty but insane, that they ought to be transferred to prison, at least in the time of the minimum possible sentence for that particular disease, I mean, for that particular offense. Something we may want to consider.
Representative Bruin, did you have a comment? No? Okay. I had you down on the list.
My son, the defense attorney.
Right. Yeah. Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlick, I think he would take you on that one.
Yes.
The problem with that, obviously, is that then, basically eliminates the insanity defense. And it's a struggle just with this particular clientele. Most of our clients, this doesn't raise an issue, but whether you can do that just solely for the substance abusers and not for our other clients, and then what do? You're shifting over the problem that we have to corrections as well. So I think that would be a...
They don't have any budget problems, I understand.
Just one more question before you go on.
Yeah.
On slide 6, the clients placed on conditional release by year.
Yes.
I guess I would like some clarification or some elaboration on this slide.
On the dip?
You have a significant increase. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a pattern to the data from the last 6 years, and then you have an interesting increase over the 2003 to 2004 cycle, which is a pretty significant increase. I don't imagine that you've had an increase in placement options like highly structured facilities that you were describing. So what can we attribute the significant rise from 2003 to 2004?
Chief Dalto, as you can see from this, I think there are factors that would explain that graph, and that is that, in the late 90s, there was a lawsuit that was threatened by the Advocacy Center, which caused the Emergency Board to provide money for 26 additional beds for PSRB clients. And so in 2000, you saw that go up. However, in the next biennium, in the 01 biennium, we didn't receive enough or any money to basically increase the number of placements in the community. So that dip explains the reduction in the number of conditional releases. Before, we had a system where there were a certain number of beds or slots in the community, and that was what we had, and when those were full, people waited. As you can see, as this line grows, we have now engaged in a concerted effort to increase these, and as Bob can tell you, the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services finally got a caseload growth factor for our clients as well. In years past, that wasn't included in the in their budget. So when that finally happened and there was caseload growth, then some of that money went to forensic clients as well as to the civil side. And so we're seeing this increase in conditional release placements with the development of additional resources in the community.
Okay, great. Thanks. Go ahead in your presentation.
The equally important aspect of the board is its monitoring function, which is where the process of revocation comes into play. Monitoring is accomplished through frequent, at times daily, contact with our case managers, receipt of monthly progress reports, and review of law enforcement data notifications if the client has entered in contact with law enforcement. In our office, we have our own LEDS terminal, which notifies us of any time that our client might come into contact with a police officer. This monitoring is done to ensure that the client is complying with the terms of their order and that their mental health status remains stable. One of the major reasons this system is so effective is that if at any time one of our clients were to violate the order of conditional release or their mental health were to deteriorate to the point that they could pose a substantial danger to others, the board has the statutory authority to revoke that conditional release and have the police return the individual to Oregon State Hospital. This can be accomplished in just a matter of hours. But once again, it is important to note that the board does not do this unilaterally. The board does not usually initiate this process. Frankly, the board does not go looking for clients to return to the state hospital. The revocations are most often the result of a county case manager's request for the board to take such action. The case manager calls the board to report a violation or a decompensation of a client's mental health. However, I can assure you that not every transgression by a client results in a revocation. And the example cited to you on Wednesday did not accurately relate all the details involved in those particular two revocations. That client that was referred to was not revoked just for a false positive urinalysis test, nor did the board revoke the other gentleman merely for drinking a beer. To the contrary, many times other interventions are utilized depending upon the particular circumstances, including increased attendance in treatment, loss of privileges, more frequent urinalysis testing, warning letters from the board, and the like. And that has always been the case.
Why then the difference in perception from the staff perspective and the information that you just provided?
Chair Dalto, I think that, frankly, and with due cause, the staff at the hospital are very frustrated with the overcrowding situation, and any new individual that comes in adds to the problem. But as you can see in what I'm going to get to, our conditional releases statistically, although the number is up average per month, the number of persons we maintain in the community remains at a very high percentage. So I think that, it just is is the result of the severe overcrowding over there. For years we averaged, four revocations a month, and these issues were not of import to, we didn't hear the complaints from the staff. But I think when you're looking at 40 or more individuals on a ward that they're, required to serve, it makes it a very difficult place to work.
But I'm sure you'd agree that the staff is pretty close to these clients, these patients on a daily basis, and may have an opportunity to observe some of these issues in greater depth and with a greater sort of exposure because of the nature of that relationship.
Chair Dalto, that's no doubt true, but what I also would tell you is that they're hearing what the reasons for the revocation were from the client, and I can tell you, frankly, in particular in one of those cases, it was not just, the person had a beer. This had happened. The person had only been out of the hospital for 10 days when they went to a bar and started drinking whiskey. It was reported to me. What we did not revoke the individual immediately. What we did was increase their the conditions of release to try and get them to attend more substance abuse treatment activities and AA meetings. Not 5 days later, the individual went back to another two more bars and continued to drink, and then expressed the fact that they were hearing voices and suffering some delusional aspects. And it was the case manager.
Does the staff have access to that information then?
Giadotto, our revocation order and affidavit is provided to the hospital. I'm not sure whether it goes right onto the into the chart of the on the ward or not. but we certainly provide a copy to the hospital. But what had happened then was the individual, you know, the community was not comfortable because the individual was experiencing, you know, symptoms of their mental illness, not just the drinking. And they had recently, before leaving the hospital, had a change of medication, and the community wanted the hospital to change the medication back because they didn't feel it was holding the individual psychiatrically, and that they didn't feel could be done in the community. So, you know, in response to the community's concerns that they weren't able to manage this person in the community, then the board has to act.
Okay,
can I just follow up on this?
Sure.
I guess following up on Representative Dalta's questions, it would seem to me that it would be part of the therapeutic process for the staff to be aware of all the things that happen so they can be dealt with in a therapy session. It was somewhat disturbing to me, I guess, hearing your story and hearing what we heard the other evening, that would be counterproductive, I would think, in working with this client.
Chidolto, Representative, I agree, and we can work on a process. I know that once the individual is admitted, the social worker contacts the community provider and, mm-hmm. and has our affidavit and writes up their, you know, psychosocial report, which should be available to all staff at the hospital as well. But, you know, we can initiate a process where that affidavit with the greater details gets to the ward, I'm sure.
Well, I appreciate your point, Representative Tomei, because I've never been in a situation of working with folks with mental illness or treating folks. But I would imagine, that trust is a fundamental part of any sort of recovery or rehabilitation, that you have to be able to, in small steps, regain the trust as the individual, as the client, with your care provider so that you can show the progression and improvement. And so if the folks that are working with that client don't have the information to hold the client accountable for saying, look, it was just one beer or something like that, you know, I think that that's an important piece of information that isn't available, perhaps, if that's the case, in helping that rehabilitation, because if the employee had that information, they could say, look, you know what, it wasn't, you know, here's the situation, or I don't know, I don't do mental health treatment, but.
Chief Dalto, I would agree, and as I said, the board does provide that to the hospital. I just don't know, you know, where it goes from the time we send it to the actual hospital, to our liaison at the hospital, how it gets to the ward and to those persons, but we'd certainly look into that.
Okay, thank you.
You know, return, as I said, to the hospital is usually the last resort. This is probably even more so of late, as the board is cognizant of the serious crisis problem confronting the hospital. Incidents that previously would have resulted in immediate return to the hospital are dealt with in other ways. For example, the use of methamphetamine, because of its dangerous effects, I will admit, used to merit an automatic trip to Salem. But now, because we have developed some appropriate alternatives in the community, the board and the community providers seek admission for the hospital, for the client, rather than to the hospital, to a residential alcohol and drug treatment program like Bridgeway here in Salem, Pathways in Columbia County, or Best Care in Bend, which frankly probably provides a quicker and more effective treatment where it can be immediate and deal with just the problem that the individual is facing at that moment. But if a revocation for revocation is the end result of the discussion with the case manager because the community believes it is no longer able to serve or manage a client, the board must and should respond with such an order. This is part of the bargain that the board has struck with our partners in getting them to agree to initially accept our clients and serve this difficult population. We have assured them that we would be there if or when there was such a need. The board cannot leave them hanging when they confront a situation that cannot be handled in a community setting. Further, to do so would endanger the public. But once returned to the hospital, they're not left there to wallow. Each client has a right to a hearing within 20 days. And while awaiting that hearing, the hospital works with the client on the issues that brought him back while the community assesses its ability and/or willingness to have the individual return to its program. If willing to reaccept, the client is routinely approved for return once their mental health is stabilized. If not, another individual is identified immediately to take that person's place in the community, and the hospital continues its treatment of the revoked person to prepare them for another conditional release in the future. The person just remains committed until a new plan can be developed. I will tell you that even though the client, after the revocation hearing, cannot apply, by law, cannot apply for another hearing for 6 months, the hospital can request a hearing at any time they believe this person is ready for re-release. As you can see from the chart, also, as I mentioned, the number of revocations has increased from a long-time steady average of 4 per month to 6 per month over the past couple of years. But so, too, has the average number of persons on conditional release, which today totals 300. But as you can see from the chart on page 8, the board continues to maintain a steady and extremely high percentage, 98.7% today, of its clients on conditional release. So the increase in revocations, I believe, correlates with the tremendous growth of the board's total population, which is something not only the hospital, but also obviously the board struggles with every day. As you can see in 2004, on one of these other charts, the board received 126 new clients, which is more than it has ever had before in 1 year. I do not see this number diminishing soon. However, I am hopeful that if we are able to continue the concerted effort undertaken this biennium to develop additional community resources and placements, that we will be able to conditional release many more, which will help with the census crisis the hospital is now facing. I believe, Chair Dalton.
Yes, on chart 8, there, that 98.7% is on a base of about 400, is that what you said?
Chair Dalton, Representative Greenlick, we have 300 on conditional release at this point today.
300. Thank you, sir.
On that point, you bring up the census crisis, and I guess, at least for the past few months, I've had some grave concerns about the crisis point at the hospital on the census. I mean, I get reports constantly, as I'm sure a lot of people do, to get the total numbers of folks out there. And I was making a note to myself. I mean, it seems to me there are a lot of people that are ready for conditional release.
Sure.
And it's time to relieve some of the pressure on the state hospital and get those people into the community. So my question to you is, can the PSRB board accommodate a significant release of people who are done with their treatment and ready to get into the community within the next couple of weeks and months here so that we can relieve some of that pressure? I mean, there's probably four dozen people that are ready to leave the hospital.
Chair Dalto, if you look at the snapshot that I've provided, you will see that of the 404 in the state hospitals of the 15th of our clients, the board has already found 43 appropriate for conditional release.
Can you tell us which page you're
on? I'm sorry, page 1. And that's snapshot of just how our clientele breaks down. So on the bottom part of the chart, you'll see that 43 have been found appropriate for conditional release. And if there were adequate resources today, those individuals could leave the hospital. It's not anything that the board is holding up. It's just we do not have, at this point, the placements in the community to serve those individuals. And that's what, obviously, we're working on. You will also see under there that there's an additional 109 community evaluations that have been ordered by the board to community mental health agencies to see whether those clients would be able to be served by the community as well. So there are a lot of people in the pipeline who were getting to the point where they could be released, but they can't go. I mean, the statute is clear that the board can't release them unless they could be adequately controlled and treated, and that means that a community has to accept them, and there has to be a you know, basically a place and a plan for them to go and follow.
So there's 43 people mm-hmm. waiting at the hospital under the jurisdiction of the PSRB. They're ready to go. They're just sitting there waiting. They're
yes.
ready to go.
Yes.
Well, I would feel pretty terrible if I was sitting in some big room waiting to go and know that I've met all my responsibilities to get released out of this institution.
Chiodotto, absolutely. And the board, this is not something new. The board has brought this to the legislature's attention. I read over when I was preparing my budget documents. I read over my presentation to this legislature for the past 3 or 4 biennium. This is not new news to have people ready at the hospital who haven't been able to be released. And it is most unfortunate. But as I said, you know, I have to tell you, I'm more hopeful than ever. Right now, we're looking at the possibility of anywhere between, you know, 50 to 90, I mean, optimistically, 90 additional beds by June 30th. I think that may be a little optimistic, but still, we will have a substantial number by June 30th, of new beds by June 30th, which will hopefully alleviate at least this number. And then if this legislature were to, you know, fund the Office of Mental Health for the additional caseload growth in the next biennium that Mr. Nickel referred to, we could continue this. As you can see that chart, you know, what has happened, frankly, if you look at the figures, I mean, it correlates with our ability to develop these programs. And when we had the money and we got 26 out, we had something. When there wasn't caseload growth, the number of conditional release went down. And then now as we've had caseload money assigned to the forensic population, we've gradually increased that again, and I think that's the reason why you saw it went from 75 to 107 even, is because there is, you know, more growth in our population. To be perfectly honest with you, I think the forensic population has been ignored in the past, or at least, you know, taken second seat to the civil side. I mean, and that's just the nature of this. You know, there's a crisis in this mental health system for all of these individuals, and at one point the focus was on the civil side, but now, you know, it has turned to the forensic side, and that attention, I believe, is long overdue.
So you're saying, I'm trying to figure out what needs to change to let these folks, these 43 folks who are ready to go out of the prison and out of the state hospital, and you're telling me, well, it seems to me that there's no place for them to go, and that's the issue, the capacity of a place. But these folks, are they folks that all need, in sort of in block, they need a structured placement, or is there a range of places that they can go?
Chiodotto, as you can also see from that snapshot, we use a variety of different residential placements. As you can see, secure residential is the least of our placements, partly because we haven't had that available to us much in the past. But yes, there are, you know, each client is assessed for their particular need, and some need secure, some you need a group home, and others may only need a foster home or some other level of care. So with this, you know, what we're hoping to achieve is a continuum of residential care throughout the community, such that we will have all the resources available so that whatever a particular client needs, they can be fit into that particular residential situation.
So for these 43, mm-hmm. there are no residential treatment facilities, no adult foster homes, no semi-independent or supported housing placements, or no independent placements? Is that what this says?
Chiodotto, no. I suppose that, you know, if there might be places for, you know, persons to go out without any support in the housing. I mean, clearly somebody could live independently. However, that is not the board's usual mode of operation, and I think there's a very good reason for it. Persons who have been in the hospital for years do not do well when they are, for the most part, our clients do not do well when they are released from the hospital to go fend for themselves. The board believes it, and I think, you know, its track record shows that it's much better to do this much as the hospital does. When you start in a maximum security, you move to a medium security, and then you get to a minimum security ward. So that's basically the process we use as well, is that most clients, the board requires to go to some kind of supported or supervised living situation to begin with. There are exceptions that we do have semi-independent situations. There are some here even in Marion County. But the vast majority of our clients, the board believes, at least need some supervision to see how they are going to adjust to the community. It is a big transition to move from such a highly structured environment. The board wants to make sure that they're going to take their medications, frankly, and so living in supervised situations allows us to have their medication monitored on a daily basis, for example. So, yeah, if this legislature were to say that these people should all, I mean, we could open the door and let them out, but that, you know, frankly, would be contrary to our statutory responsibility, which is to provide the adequate care and treatment and supervision in the community. And frankly, I don't think the community providers would accept responsibility. We have to have the community accept them also, and so they want them to have the appropriate services and supports that they need as well.
Okay, I mean, I hear what you're saying. I don't think anybody's suggesting that we should open any doors for folks who need that kind of structure, but it seems to me that out of these 43 people, if you have some independent placement settings, like with family, if people can go home, I don't know how many can go home or what the story is, but I mean, I guess I refuse to believe that there isn't a track record of success at some level for some kind of placement. I mean, it reminds me, you know, of Casablanca in the beginning of the movie, where these people are sitting and waiting and waiting, and they want to go and they're ready to go, and they don't have any place to go. They can't get out. And I would feel horrible. These people are in my district. I get these letters all the time from people saying, hey, I'm sitting here and I want to get out of here and I can't go anyplace. So you can understand how I feel about this.
Sure, Chiodalto, and the board shares that frustration. I will tell you, I get those calls, I get those letters all the time, but I think we would also do a disservice to the client. I mean, sure, they're going to call you and tell you, I mean, write you and say, I want out and just let me out, but frankly, I think we would be doing not only a disservice to the public, but to the client if they're not released with the supports and services and treatment resources that they need. And as I said, the community is that integral partner, and they're the ones that want to determine what level of care and what kind of services these individuals need in order to accept them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mary Claire, I understand what you're saying. They've been living in a very structured situation, and so you sort of decrease the structure as they progress. So I'm wondering if on page one, when it starts out with secure residential treatment facilities, is that sort of how they progress? Do they start out at that and then go down to residential treatment, adult foster homes, supported housing, and independence, or alone with family? Is that sort of how the progress?
Chiodalto, Representative Tomei, this, I would sort of take the secure residential off that, but I would say that most of our clients either begin in a residential treatment home or facility or a foster home and then work their way to semi-independent and then independent living. Secure residential, you know, is reserved for those persons who really continue to need a locked facility but don't need maybe the psychiatric care that's provided at the state hospital.
It was interesting to me, 35.5%.
Sure.
are either living independently or living with their families, mm-hmm. And that's a big percentage.
Yes, and Chiodalto, Representative Tomei, that is how they've, you know, basically progressed to that point. As you see, that is the majority, and they, you know, gradually earn that.
They earn that, so they're not usually then sent from the hospital directly into their home or living independently. Thank you.
Okay. You can proceed with your presentation.
I think, Chiodalto, that covers the areas that I was asked to address, and if there are any other further questions, I'd be happy to answer, but thank you for this opportunity.
Are there any questions from the panel? I have, as you can imagine, some more questions, because I don't often have a chance to visit with the PSRB, so here's the decision that I'm going to make for the rest of our agenda. I'm going to pull Mike Morris and Delia Cruz off our agenda. I'm going to keep Dr. Lipkin and Dr. Jefferson with Peace Health because I imagine they drove up from Eugene to talk to us about the psychiatric inpatient care, and we'll get Bob June deaf, and we will apologize to Mike Morris and Delia Cruz, but try to figure out how we can get that information at another time, but we just we're going to run up against it. We still have some questions about the PSRB itself to understand a little bit more about how that works. So my first question is, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the board itself. You described the five slots for the different folks. What is the status of the PSRB board right now? Who's on the board? What's going on with the board?
Chair Dalto, now the psychiatrist member is Dr. George Saslow, who has been on the board for, I would bet, 18 years or so, but who unfortunately at this point is not serving with us because of some health problems. He's actually a 98-year-old esteemed psychiatrist from Oregon Health Sciences University. The psychologist member is Dr. Cliff Johansson. Our attorney member is Dorothy Morey of Eugene, and our public member is Vern Fotz. What the situation is right now is both, our probation officer is Kim Drake from Washington County. All of these individuals, I've been most fortunate to have a very stable board for a long period of time, as you can tell. Most of our board members are on their second, if not third, or longer term. However, the psychiatrist and the probation officer positions lapsed last June, and the governor's appointments office has been in the process of looking for replacements for those two positions. This June, the public member and the attorney member's position lapse, and it is the governor's intention to replace those two members as well. And then next June, June 06, the psychologist position will become open. So the board is going to be faced with some tremendous changes in the next 15 to 16 months. I will tell you that we're having an extraordinarily difficult time replacing the psychiatrist member. Part of this is because these are professional persons who and our per diem is only $289.22 at this point. And to find a psychiatrist who's willing to give up a day, and it takes, frankly, more than a day nowadays. We have gone from holding maybe 6 to 8 hearings 10 years ago to holding 12 to or more hearings per day and handling 18 matters a day. We provide these members with all the exhibit files prior to the hearing, and so they have to take time to prepare the hearings on the weekend before, and then on Mondays it takes we start at 8:30 and go through the docket until they're done. So it's a substantial commitment of time and energy for these folks, and we have not yet been able to find a psychiatrist in the community who is willing to serve for such meager recompense, is what they tell me.
How many days is this? Every week?
Chair Dalton, Representative Tomei, the board used to meet on a weekly basis. However, because of budget constraints, we now only meet and on an average of 3 times a month. So it isn't for board members. It probably means at least serving on 2 days a month because we don't sit for the whole panel. Another budget saving thing years ago, I believe, was to sit as panels of 3. And so that's where we are now. I think the governor's office may soon be able to announce an appointment for the probation officer, but now we're in the process of looking for replacements for the, as I said, the public member and the attorney member. So we're in a state of...
Four positions. You have 2 that have been vacant for almost a year.
Well, Chiodalto...
There are people sitting there.
Yeah, they continue to serve, yes.
Right, but you have two that have been vacant for almost a year,
mm-hmm.
and then you have another two coming up this June, and then the other one after that.
Yeah.
At some point, has the PSRB asked for more money to increase those per diems?
Chair Dalto, I've had that discussion with the governor's office due to the difficulty of finding replacements, and I think they're examining that very issue right now, given that right now they can't find anybody.
Okay. All right. I think I have the information I want on that. I have another question then. You mentioned one of the options for disposition of clients is to place them in a highly structured facility.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, I mean, there were three options. I think the hospital, highly structured facility, and then another option. Is that right?
Chiodalto, highly structured program. It doesn't necessarily have to be a highly structured residential placement, yes.
Okay, so are people going to the hospital then because you don't have a placement for them in a highly structured program?
Do you mean from the court?
From the PSRB.
Well,
the PSRB has somebody, and they're making a decision about how to work with the client, with the disposition of the client. And so the PSRB board comes to an agreement that, or a consensus that the person should be placed in a highly structured program. But there isn't a placement available for them. So then, do they get sent to the hospital if they have to be placed somewhere and there isn't a placement for them in a highly structured program? Do they go to the hospital? How does that work?
Chiodalto, they would be in the hospital when the board's making the decision about their conditional release. We do have, as I said, 25% of our clients are court conditional released, and so they would remain in the community unless and until there was some violation or reason to return them to the hospital. The persons, if the board were, and the community, frankly, through an evaluation process, determined that an individual currently in the hospital needs a certain level of care in order for the community to accept them, then yes, that person stays in the hospital till a bed opens in whatever facility has been identified to best serve this individual's needs. So, for example, if we sent out an evaluation to a community mental health agency and they said, yes, we're willing to take them, but only at, you know, the... other place, which I think Mr. Ader spoke to you about the other evening, which is a secure residential treatment facility. They don't believe that the person could be adequately managed in a less secure or structured environment, then that individual would be held in the hospital waiting for a bed at that level of care. Yes.
Okay. And my other question is, if I wonder if you could talk a bit about the PSRB in the context of its relationship with the Department of Human Services and then the counties and then the state hospital as a whole, and talk about the collaboration, the nature of the collaboration with the hospital in particular and the PSRB board.
Well, Chair Dalto, I think that, as I said, by the very nature of this system, we have to be collaborative. We're all partners in this system. With the hospital, as I said, you know, that's the place where the clients go for inpatient care, and you know, right now, I think there are, what they tell you, 400 of our clients are in that hospital. And we have to work with them closely. I, you know, talk to hospital staff on a daily basis. I also am working with the superintendent on issues that are of concern both to the board and to the hospital in terms of treatment or services that the board may think different, you know, clients need. With regards to the Office of Mental Health, because of the way the whole system was structured, the board's budget only includes the money to pay for the staffing and the board's stipends. When the system was designed, the money for the care and treatment of our clients remained in the, at that time, the mental health division's budget. And so, obviously, the hospital, the care for the hospital comes out of that budget. And then community placements, the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Service now pays for this residential treatment and supervision services. So we're obviously inextricably, you know, connected with them as well. The development, obviously, it happens happens through the office, because they're going to be contracting. We don't do the direct contracts with the providers that provide service for our clients. The Office of Mental Health does. So we work with them in developing these new resources, in working out issues when clients need services that may not be covered under the health plan, for example, and the Office of Mental Health has to pay for services that the board might order that aren't covered. For example, sex offender treatment. If the board orders somebody to have sex offender treatment, that isn't covered, and so we would ask the Office of Mental Health to provide the additional funding for that. And obviously the community is an integral part, because we cannot release people unless a community mental health agency or some provider has agreed to accept and is willing to, you know, assume the responsibility for reporting to the board, which is required by statute, as well as, you know, provide the treatment that our clients need. So, you know, what we see is all these individual stakeholders are, as I said, tightly linked in dealing with this population.
So how well is that working, your relationship with the department?
You know, Chair Dalto, I would say that I work quite well, and historically have done very well with, you know, we've developed a network of community providers that we depend upon, and with the Office of Mental Health, work very closely. And with the hospital, I think clearly sometimes, I mean, just by the nature of this structure, there are going to be tensions, and I think those are healthy ones. They're probably a little more intense these days because of the crisis that we're all facing. The hospital has a great deal of pressure on it. The board has, you know, pressures on it, and so does the office. And so we have to, you know, work through those to be sure that we're all doing, because we all, you know, frankly, also have, although we're working together, we also have some different mandates from this legislature, frankly, and our missions are not exactly the same. And as I said, you know, sometimes I'm sure it's difficult for, you know, the hospital or staff to, you know, to understand, you know, that the protection of the public is the board's primary duty. And sometimes that, I think, contributes to some of the frustration with in the system in terms of this the releasing of our clients or what have you. But overall, I think you know we've done very well historically. As I said, it's just I'm sure lately the pressures are on all of us, and that's always a.
Well, the recidivism rate itself, the number that you put forward at 2% is remarkable, mm-hmm. I think, and I think it's extremely low, and I guess I'm having trouble understanding how it's working so well if, you know, we are, if we are trying to do our best in getting people out of state custody. I mean, there are a lot of suggestions and a lot of complaints that the PSRB board is pretty heavy-handed in maintaining control over some of these folks. And I think that when you have nearly nobody returning back to that jurisdiction, I mean, what is that telling us? Is that telling us that you guys are hanging on to them for a long time and exerting a lot of control until a point where they're not going to come back? Or what's your interpretation of the criticism?
Chair Dalto, once again, I want to stress that what happens with these clients is not just a, you know, unilateral matter of from the board.
You yourself said sometimes you get one panel of three people that'll rule one way on a certain disposition, then you'll get another panel made up of the same board that might go in a different direction.
Yeah, that was regarding the alcohol and drug situation.
But there's consistency within the board.
Chiodalto, I don't think that's the case in regards to conditional release. I mean, most of the time the board is responding to, it is brought to the board after an individual. I tell you how the process works is the hospital would ask us for to order an evaluation in the community. Then that evaluation goes out to the community. If the community accepts them and develops a plan, comes before the board, it is rare that the person doesn't get out. And then they're subject to certain conditions. And then those conditions remain in effect unless and until either the client or their case manager were to ask the board to modify that conditional release. And, you know, I've run the data on that too, and the modifications when somebody in the community, the case manager asks for individuals, either their residential or some of their treatment conditions to be relaxed, the board does that on a frequent basis. I mean, it's just a matter of course that as these requests are made of the board, that it starts out, you know, with a pretty structured plan, but as people do well, they move through the residential system, as I said, and I also, you know, all of the conditions are, you know, so people start off seeing their case manager, some of them, you know, every day of the week. Then it becomes once a week, then it might become twice a month, then it becomes, you know, over a period of time, and that's how, you know, it operates, but it's the board relies on the community provider to make those requests. I think right now we're in the process of the Office of Mental Health has initiated a new position for utilization review because, frankly, they're the ones, as I said, that have the contract with these providers, and I think what we will end up, you know, having a process where maybe those cases could be reviewed on an annual basis to see whether, in fact, you know, additional, you know, loosening might occur either in the conditions or in a review of their residential placement. But, you know, the board does nothing unless somebody comes to the board and asks for the board to take some action. So unless a community, you know, as I said, the case manager requested the person to move to a less restrictive alternative, the client remains in that particular position. We don't have, you know, the intimate knowledge on a daily basis of these clients, nor do we have, you know, the staffing or ability to be, you know, initiating, you know, these reviews on our own. We have a hard enough time, you know, keeping up with the hearings that we're required to provide to these clients on, you know, by statute. So we don't, you know, go out and actually solicit, you know, reductions and thing. We rely on the community providers to notify us when they think in their clinical judgment changes to that plan should be made.
But you have control over these clients. So irrespective of the staffing issues, which we can get to in a moment, but, I mean, doesn't the board think that one of the responsibilities of having control over these lives is to you know, actively ensure that if there's a way to reduce the level of structure and get people to have a little bit more freedom, if it's warranted, that the PSRB board should be more proactive in that? Because I think what I hear you saying is, look, we don't have the resources to do that. We're struggling to keep up with our meetings and our normal workload, so we can't even look into the future to be proactive in trying to get these folks out of PSRB control. But you have the department that you can work with that might have some of those resources, or the PSRB board could come and ask for additional resources to help move these people out of PSRB. Does that make sense?
Chiodalto, yes. And I think the board does, you know, move people through its system. As you can see from that chart, you know, the majority of people aren't living in supervised living situations.
But only reactively. If you have a community provider, I think what you just said was a community provider would come and say, look, this person has done this, has accomplished this, could benefit from a lesser level of structure or whatever. So we, you know, do we have permission to move them along? I think that's what I hear the board saying. But I don't think it doesn't have to be that way.
Why do you think people
are waiting and waiting and waiting to get out?
Chiodalto, we are in the process of working on it. As I said, the Office of Mental Health has a position. They received positions in from the e-board in January to deal with this process. The board did not. Frankly, in the past, that has not been, if you review, you know, our statutory function, it has not been, you know, to review these cases for the appropriateness of their, you know, of the level of care, except when the patient requested the hearing or, you know, a case manager. I mean, as you see in that chart, there are certain types of hearings. But if this legislature, you know, wants us to institute something, then obviously, you know, we'd be more than willing to do that. We've been, you know, working with the Office of Mental Health on that utilization review position, you know, very recently. And I think we've, you know, we talked about that, you know, years ago, but once again, you know, the resources weren't available. But, you know, we had talked about having annual reviews of clients who are living in the community to assess whether that, you know, that level of care was, you know, still appropriate. And I think certainly there is a need for that. The question in my mind is, you know, which part, you know, which agency should, you know, should have that responsibility. And, you know, my understanding was that the Office of Mental Health with that utilization review person was going to take that and then bring recommendations to the board. However, you know, if this legislature chose to have the board take on that responsibility, if we had the appropriate, you know, staffing resources, we could do that too. But I can tell you at this point, you know, I have requested an additional staff person just to manage the increase in caseload. Since the last time I appeared before this legislature 2 years ago, we went from 600 to 728 clients. I have three staff persons in addition to myself. That is the same staffing pattern that has existed since 1988. And at that time, we had 420 individuals under the board's jurisdiction. So, I mean, just the day-to-day operations of managing the hearings and the and everything that is attendant with, because you have to understand also that nothing happens about these clients without some action of the board or its staff. You know, an evaluation, the request comes to the board, my staff has to prepare and send it out to the community. The community's response comes back, the monthly reports comes back. I mean, all of this stuff, you know, comes to the board first. And so, you know, from a workload issue, I don't know that I could, you know, and frankly, we only have limited number of funded, budgeted hearing days. And so to ask the board to add, you know, mandatory review hearings or what have you would also, you know, have to have some increased funding for those kind of hearing days.
Very clear, my understanding you to say that if you had more staff, the people could go through this process on a quicker basis, more people could be either homes or in an unsupervised situation, but it's the lack of staff that's causing the fewer hearings and fewer possibilities of people both moving out of the hospital and also moving out of moving into a more independent situation and living with families, etc.
Sure, also, Representative Tomei, to a degree, I mean, what I would say is that the lack of, you know, or my concern about the lack of staffing in my office is the more individuals that are placed on conditional, we're responsible for monitoring them in the community, and right now there are 300. If in fact the office is successful in getting 90 more out by June 30th, same staff will be responsible for monitoring 390 people, and they anticipate another 100 next biennium. And so we're doing that monitoring in order to do, as Chair Dalto suggested, and also add a level of review of the, you know, persons who are currently in the community and whether they, you know, that the community is, you know, somehow not moving fast enough or that we could move these individuals, you know, quicker to less restrictive alternatives would certainly take, you know, that additional resource.
Thank you.
Representative.
I'm just stunned. I have to say, I find this fascinating, the level of responsibility and accountability that you have to take these people who we've been listening to stories and anecdotal information and just general case history information over from the beginning of this committee's hearing, and it's gone through these different permutations and stages, and these are the most difficult people in our state that these guys are responsible for, and I can't imagine going to work every day and having that burden of responsibility, because we don't notice it unless something happens, and then it gets in the paper, and then it's blown up in the press, and everybody says, oh my God, the state's screwing up again. And I have to hand it to you all, everybody in the room who's working in this arena, it's unbelievable. And I know this is a crisis situation in our state, not just Oregon, I'm sure it's a lot around our country, but I go home at night and I just am grateful that somebody's out there doing this. So thank you.
Chair Dalton, Representative Boone, thank you.
I just have one last question. How could the relationship work better with the PSRB and the Department of Human Services, the Mental Health and Addictions Office, to work on behalf of some of these patients? And what isn't working well? What could work better?
Chair Dalto, I think it is working quite well. I will tell you that, you know, for a number, at some point there was, they had an individual staff person assigned to be the PSRB liaison that disappeared in the past, and then it came back, and right now it is filled. I work with that individual on a daily basis. We have a very good and collaborative relationship. We are, you know, together more than I'm with him, more than I'm with my staff some weeks in terms of this, you know, development. And so, you know, I'm not sure what you're hearing, but from my perspective, you know, we work well together.
No, I was hearing you talk about the tension.
Well, you know, Chair Dalto, there's always going to be a tension in this system.
What's the nature of the tension?
Just because of, you know, our different statutory responsibilities. You know, they're to care and treat. We're, you know, responsible for the care and treatment or the oversight of that care and treatment. But, you know, our primary purpose is to protect the public. So there's always that tension. You know, the hospital would love to open the door today, and I can't blame them, and let these individuals out. But it's the board's, you know, job to be that intermediary, so that what happened in prior history doesn't happen again, that we don't just release people without the necessary supports and services they need in the community. And so, you know, that there's a healthy tension. I bug them, they bug me. I mean, you know, frankly, I mean, if we the board needs something or doesn't think that something is being done, you know, I pick up the phone and call Bob Nickel, and if, you know, and they, you know, call me when they think that, you know, we're not responding. So so I think, you know, it is a, you know, healthy to have that kind of relationship. It doesn't preclude us from working well together, but it's just the nature of the business, frankly.
Can you give me an example of when you might be at odds?
Which you'd also... I think, you know, at times there may be, as you said, some, you know, interest in developing certain types of, I'm trying to think of something recent, in looking at some of the clients or the situation right now, that, you know, there was a question as to whether we should just let a number of these individuals go out to independent living situations or what have you. And, you know, clearly that's not the board's preference in most cases. There are certainly some very high-functioning individuals under our jurisdiction who have come under for whatever, who could go to, you know, less structured. But
when's the last time that's happened?
I'm sorry?
When's the last time the PSRB has allowed somebody to leave the hospital who is ready to be released and gone into semi-independent structure?
Chair Dalto, probably within the last few weeks. There are, you know, facilities, as I said, we're in the process of doing that right now. I mean, there's a cottage here in Marion County that's semi-independent. There are facilities in Multnomah County that are... set up, if it's, you know, supported housing, which, you know, we release our clients to. So it happens regularly.
All right. Thanks for indulging me. I appreciate your testimony. Thanks. You did a great job. And we appreciate you being here. So we will excuse Mary Claire Buckley and move on to our last panel, Dr. Lipkin and Dr. Jefferson with Peace Health and Eugene, who are going to give us a presentation on psychiatric inpatient care. So good morning still. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm not Dr. Jefferson. I'm Dr. Sandra Sheets.
This is Dr. Sandra Sheets.
Okay.
We're here representing the Oregon Psychiatric Inpatient Committee, but we're the management team for mental health at Peace Health in Eugene, Sacred Heart Medical Center particularly. I think to begin with, I should emphasize my gray hair and try to limit the history that I give you. I've been in psychiatry for over 35 years. I've been in Oregon more or less for 30 or so of them. And when I got here, we had about 1,500 additional psychiatric beds. And I think they were mostly well utilized. The mental health division, OMHAS, these days has done a pretty good job of moving people into the community. But there is a limit. So I want to say some things which may be somewhat critical of where we are today, but also want to be clear that I'm quite complimentary of Bob Nickel and his staff and the struggles that they're going through, as Ms. Buckley, you know, referenced in some ways for PSRB, to deal with the problem that we have. And I think the problem that we have is that there are more patients needing more services than we have been prepared to provide. What's happening, I was on call last night at Sacred Heart. About 8 o'clock last night, I had to go to the hospital because we had a patient who needed to be hospitalized. He tried to wrestle a car into submission, and of course he lost. After his scrapes and bruises and some cuts were sewed up, we didn't have a bed. Our 34 available beds were full. We had to look for a bed, and fortunately we could find one in Corvallis, a mere, you know, hour away, 45 minutes away. It is common for us these days to send patients to Portland, to receive patients from Portland when they're full, or to send patients from Eugene to Medford, which makes very little sense. The reasons that that is happening are complex, but we've reached a point at which the available community beds simply aren't sufficient to address the needs of our state. The state hospital has always been the place in our system where patients who needed longer stays than our average 5 to 7 days could be treated for a little longer so that our short stay beds could continue to turn over rapidly. Over the past months, we've been averaging, I think, 4 to 6 patients awaiting a state hospital bed. That's a serious problem because that means 6 people occupy a bed for an average of 29 days. That's the average length between getting somebody accepted by the state hospital and getting them admitted. We would have run a significant number of other people. We would have accommodated a lot of other people in those 6 beds in 30 days. I think 25 or 30 of them, to be precise. In addition, my call last night, I talked with 2 people who are frequently seen at our hospital in short stays, both of whom are suicidal, have no beds for them. I talked to one person who's having a medication problem who would have been better observed in the hospital than left at home to talk to her doctor in the morning, but couldn't do a thing about that either. We could invite them to the emergency department, but that's not really much of a solution. Now, there are a lot of kinds of fallout for this problem. One of them is, and it will affect all of us sooner or later, when we have patients who need a psychiatric bed and don't have a psychiatric bed available, if the patient is reasonably manageable in our community and in our hospital, they often get admitted to a medical bed. At Sacred Heart, and I believe at many of the other hospitals in the state, medical beds, particularly in the winter, but sometimes even in the fall and in the summer, have been at a premium. There are not enough of those either. So what happens now is that a person who has chest pain and is going to have a procedure or a workup in the hospital may sit in our emergency room for 12 hours because there aren't any beds available. And so it's kind of a constant struggle to move people through the hospital at the rate that they get the care they need and still find room for people who are coming in. We are, from time to time, having to cancel elective surgery because we don't have a bed to put the person in. And the psychiatric patients who would normally go to the state hospital would have, 5 years ago, would have, 3 years ago, are part of this problem. They're not the whole problem, but they're certainly an important part of it. In dealing with the state hospital system, we've also discovered recently that there are patients who are committed by the court system who pass the legal tests of being dangerous to self or others, who the state hospital refuses to accept. Now, that puts us, the community hospitals, not just Sacred Heart, all of us, in a very interesting bind. We have somebody the court says is dangerous to self or others, and the state hospital says, not dangerous enough for us to do anything about. That leads to long lengths of stay in acute hospital beds where we're really not terribly well equipped to do that, for all the reasons I've just outlined. Furthermore, because emergency departments are the entries to care almost throughout the entire state, emergency departments are seeing more and more psychiatric problems and having no place to send them if the patient needs an admission.
I think Representative Greenlick at our last meeting, or perhaps another meeting, was describing a situation where people are sitting in the emergency room, psychiatric people are sitting in the emergency room for as much as a week before they're able to be placed in a more long-term.
That's been the case frequently in Portland, where the problems are most severe. We don't have an emergency room in Eugene that can deal with that. If we did that, there'd be no room for anybody with a fracture, no anybody who had a car wreck. So we have to move them through, and we are moving them in all sorts of creative ways. One of the problems that we're having, I think, as well, is that in terms of recognizing that the state has a budgetary problem, the state is sharing that budgetary problem in a most elegant way with the community hospitals, because the state hospital will pay for accepted patients if they're on the Oregon Health Plan, but they won't pay for them if they're indigent and committed and awaiting state hospital bed. That means that the community hospitals are picking up a larger and larger portion of the cost of indigent care because the federal rules require us to do that. And I think Sacred Heart doesn't object to doing some of that. We've always done a good deal of charity care. But we're getting to the place where it makes no sense whatsoever to have a psychiatric unit from an economic point of view, because it becomes a magnet for increasingly unfunded care of patients who you can't deal with effectively in a short time. So there's a couple of layers of difficulty in that. And we're hoping to see some progress around getting clear what the state's commitment is, getting clear what the responsibilities of the local hospitals are. While I'm on the topic, let me talk a little bit about how we do this process. Because at the present time, the state of Oregon, through OMHAS, addresses the mental health problems of the state by dealing with the county government's health and human services folks. And in some ways I understand why that is, but it's causing some interesting problems because the county says we're only responsible to provide care up to the availability of funds. And yet the county and the state are working very hard to deal with the state hospital crisis by bringing more people into the community. If you bring more people into the community, lo and behold, mental health patients have more medical and surgical needs than the average population. And community hospitals are getting more and more patients from these transfers for whom there's no funding source frequently, for whom there's no plan of care. So the psychiatric inpatient units as a group would plead with you as a committee or with the legislature to find a mechanism so that the community hospitals that are providing the bulk of the acute care and the emergency departments that are providing the bulk of the access are involved in the discussions with the community mental health centers, the county governments, and the OMHAS as plans are made. Because if we plan to move people, as Ms. Buckley was discussing, out of the forensic unit into Lane County, I promise you that some of them will end up in our hospital. And if they're psychiatrically ill and in our hospital and we can't move them back to state hospital for days and days and days and days, it becomes again a problem in terms of staffing, in terms of facilities, and in terms of the impact on my family members and yours in terms of getting services in the hospital. So there's a complex ripple effect from not addressing the psychiatric needs. And I think all of our group would like to see better collaboration in terms of active planning for new programs or active management of existing funds between OMHAS, county government, and the community hospital for not-for-profits.
I'm going to add to that.
Mr. Chair?
Chair.
I have a question. How many of these cases, these admits, are the mentally ill you're describing that are coming into community care and utilizing those beds?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
How many patients are you admitting that through the emergency department that are, would normally be going, the mentally ill patients that would normally be going to the state hospital or through another venue somehow that you're...
Well,
maybe I misunderstood what you're saying, is that they're utilizing beds that now either in the emergency department or in the hospital that would be gone to other non...
I apologize. Maybe I haven't been clear enough. Let me try. The number of patients who need psychiatric care in any community is something you can statistically approximate. Lane County, as an example, had 48 beds until the middle of March last year, at which time the county closed Lane County Psych Hospital. That was 12 beds. That brought us down to 36 beds. A significant number of the patients that we saw at Sacred Heart and at Lane County Psychiatric Hospital saw are patients with chronic, recurring, severe, persistent mental illness, some of whom respond very well to treatment and go back, you know, in 5 to 15 days, but some of whom need more like 4 to 6 weeks to get better at all, or a few need more. Because the state hospital isn't able to take those patients these days, they sit in our acute beds. And then when people overdose, and then when people are depressed, they get overflowed into psychiatric beds when there are any available. And many weekends in the state of Oregon, there's no bed, unless you happen to get a discharge.
So that,
and those patients then get stacked up in medical beds or surgical beds in community hospitals across the state, particularly our hospital, because those are the ones I have experience dealing with, where they are in effect blocking other people who need care.
That's the ones I was talking about. How many are those? How many are?
How many are getting moved into other beds mm-hmm. around the hospital? Mm-hmm. We're running 4 to 6 a week.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. That's about 10% then, maybe? Or less, maybe more.
We're running 90 to 100 admissions a month.
Actually, 120. We're up to
125. So it's 5 to 6% of the total admission, but these are not people who we think should be in medical surgical beds at all.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Lichten, two questions. What percentage of the patients that you're seeing right now have drug or alcohol related direct issues? And secondly, in the time of financial and fiscal crisis, and Oregon's not alone. I mean, there's only other 49 other states that have the same problem we do. But what are the other states doing? Have we drained off so much money through the Oregon Health Plan for other areas that we don't have enough in relationship to other states, other enough resources, or what are we doing that's wrong, or what states are doing something right that we could copy?
I'm not sure I'm smart enough to answer those questions, sir, but a fair percentage, 15%, 20% of patients who come in, I think, have some associated substance use disorder, but we routinely don't admit people if it's primary alcoholism. There are a couple of programs in the community that do that. If somebody needs major detox because they're in danger of dying of delirium treatments, they are directly admitted to medical floor, and it's usually a short stay. If they can be managed more conservatively, they go to Buckley House, which is a social detox program, or to Serenity Lane, which is a substance use program. As far as what are other states doing, some other states have moved to mental health parity. And in that situation, at least, mental health services are covered the same as other services. We haven't quite gotten there in that regard. The coverage for mental health services in Oregon in the mental health plan have had a kind of cyclical up and down course over the past couple of years. For a while, people lost benefits, or they thought they lost them, or they lost prescription coverage, or they thought they lost it. And so I think perhaps we've had an increase in admissions of people who crumbled because they didn't get maintenance. Now, pharmaceuticals are one of the problems in all of this, and other states have not done terribly well at solving it. There are programs afoot here that may help with costs to some degree, but it's probably still cheaper to pay the pharmaceutical costs than it is to pay the daily bed care costs in a hospital. And we can keep many people out of the hospital if we can keep seeing them on an outpatient basis. So those places that have done the best job with this, I think, have made enough resources available to keep people in the community. That's always been the plan. On the way up here, I was thinking about an old joke about how two can live as cheaply as one, but it costs twice as much. It has to do with marriage. Well, we can manage psychiatric patients with major mental illness in the community as cheaply as we can in a hospital, but it costs about the same. That is, in Maryland, where I worked in the past, and in a number of other states, and in the Veterans Administration, where I've worked in the past. The research is pretty clear that if you're really going to pay for the things that need to be paid for to keep people out, which have to do medical care, pharmaceuticals, housing, etc., you end up spending very much the same public dollar as you would if you kept them in a state facility that was run for the purpose. It's better for the patients, and in some ways it's better for the budget overall to have community services adequately funded. I don't believe we've ever had them adequately funded. Because it's very difficult to arrange to do that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Right.
Thank you. My mother used to say, two can live as cheaply as one, but look as cheaply as one, too. can psychologists be of some help? We've got a couple of pieces of legislation right now before us in the legislative process relative to psychologists who will do the additional three-year pharmacology work and assist. And we have a very capable associate in the House of Representatives who is a psychologist, doctor of psychology, and it's his considered opinion, and I agree with him, that those folks who are trained in those particular areas might be of some assistance with the ability to prescribe and manage psychotropic drugs. Do you have any opinion one way or the other?
You know, if I were going to be a properly disciplined chauvinist and represent psychiatry, I'd have to say it's not a good idea. I don't quite want to go that far. But the current legislation, as I understand it, puts absolutely all of the monitoring and control and tracking for psychologists prescribing in the hands of the psychologist board. And that's a little too much like having the fox guard the henhouse. If we're going to have this work well, I believe you have to have some psychiatric participation, some nurse participation, and some pharmacy participation in that project. if that's done and if people have suitable high-quality training, I think it may not be a disaster at all. And it will expand our available manpower, person power. But if it's only going to be by psychologists and monitored by them, they may not be sufficiently equipped to recognize that they're going sideways a little bit.
I appreciate their perspective. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Boone?
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you thought if we had mental health parity here, how much better would that make things?
Well, it's better in a bunch of different ways. First of all, something like 20% of our population will have some need for mental health services in a given year. And if you look at your family, if you look at my family, if you look at... We almost all know somebody who's got a serious anxiety problem or has had a serious depression or has some other sort of difficulty. With mental health parity, the availability of prompt outpatient treatment is much higher. People will actually seek it if they can get it covered. When that happens, first of all, the use of hospitals comes down. You prevent suicide attempts to some degree. Not all of them, but some of them. You prevent a lot of relapses of bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, and you do it for vastly less price. That's a place where putting money into outpatient services saves an enormous amount of inpatient money. So the problem with no parity, or the parity that we have, which is kind of an evasive parity, I'm afraid, that is, we count visits instead of paying for services as we would for a diabetic, is that patients do not seek outpatient care when they need it. They try to get some help from their primary care physicians often, but if they need specialized care, they're very reluctant to get it if they don't have enough coverage. Mm-hmm. And so they end up in the hospital. Now, I don't know whether we would save a lot of hospital beds, but we'd certainly improve the ability to move patients promptly through them if outpatient care was...
Well, just a follow-up. And it's just a comment. The Public Employees Benefit Board has been paying for mental health parity through the insurance program, and it's apparently the cost is less than 0.5%. And so the argument by the insurance companies who are arguing this and a large business organization are pretty erroneous in that sense when they're saying it's going to bankrupt the system, because if that's the truth and you're paying, say, 0.5 cent on this end to enable people to go to their doctors and get medication or get treatment, they're very, the same way they do for a physical ailment, the money, and like you said, the bed use will be down, but it also, in the long run, they'll be managed on a preventive basis early and often if they need to be, but there won't be that stigma of they only have 10 visits and so they have to use them very carefully.
I think you're absolutely correct. The statistics, as I understand them, are that PEB has been, as you said, the worst case examples have been, I think, in the automobile workers and some other unions where the management wasn't quite as good as it's been here.
There's a bill.
And they got up as high as 4%. Now, 4% is still way ahead of where we are now. So I agree with you totally that this is scare tactics by the insurance industry because they just don't want to go there.
Thank you.
Representative Tamim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm confused about a statement you made a few minutes ago about two can live as cheaply as one, only costs twice as much. So could you clarify that for me?
Sure.
You seem to be saying that it costs as much to keep somebody out of the hospital setting as it does to treat them in a hospital setting, but I can't believe that's really what you meant.
Well, I did say that. You heard me correctly. Let me clarify it.
Okay.
For the small percentage of people who have major mental illness of a chronic and severe kind, the folks who are most likely to use state hospital beds for long periods of time, I believe it is true that the amount of money it costs to keep them effectively in the community is not very much less than it would be to keep them in a state hospital that was in good physical shape and, you know, able to be maintained adequately and staffed appropriately.
Hmm.
the discussion we just had about more routine care for more routine problems, it's much cheaper to do outpatient services. That's a different situation. The most expensive patients are the patients who end up in the state hospital. And depending on where you are, that's going to be $50,000 a year and up. Now, in providing assertive community treatment, housing options, appropriate medical care, all of which you need to do to keep them out of the hospital, the severely and persistently mentally ill cost very much the same amount of money. It's much better for the patients. It's much better for the society. And it allows you to have a more compact state hospital kind of operation. But it isn't vastly cheaper. It's just better. It's a quality issue, I believe.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Just a comment, if I might. I really appreciate your candor and your honesty and willingness to say these things to us. Thank you.
Dr. Sheets, do you have a further testimony to add?
I would like to just add on to one of the earlier questions, I believe, Representative Butler asked about what are other states doing. I believe that
we're... Can you identify yourself first?
I'm sorry. Dr. Sandra Sheets. Some of the there's some new programs getting started here in Oregon, which there are models for around the country. Programs like the assertive community treatment, some of the vocational programs, some of the evidence-based practices that are being developed. I think that what we're limited in numbers of those programs, but there are many programs around the country which have been effective, and I think that it would be well worth the investment to build some more of those programs. Recently, Peace Health, partly in self-defense for all the indigent patients coming into the hospital who had no resources to leave the hospital, no psychiatric care, no psychiatry, no methods to pay for medications, that we've created what we call a transition team. The county contributed the time of a psychiatrist. Some of the dollars that were passed through from the state are being used to pay for medications. We've provided three staff. Those are two social workers and a psychologist who have been assertively reaching out to these individuals and helping them get out of the hospital when it's not the medical acuity, their psychiatric illness, that's keeping them there, but rather the social resources that they need, these access to services as well as a place to live. So these additional kinds of wraparound programs are really helpful, even for those who are not the chronically and seriously and persistently mentally ill. And I think the other major area that we really need to address for all our vulnerable populations really are housing programs, supportive housing programs. There's just a real dearth of placements and communities for these people to live. And without a place to live, then the problems are just exacerbated and they end up recycling and back into the emergency rooms, back into hospitals, and then back on the streets.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. We're going to adjourn our hearing.
Mr. Before we adjourn, there was a article in the Oregonian front page today of a young man who committed suicide, and what a loss that is to the community, to the city of Portland, to people who knew him and loved him. And there was a young woman who committed suicide who had been the staff person for this committee several years ago, who was also young, left a family. And I think that it's incumbent on us as a committee, as a legislature, as a society, to look at the stigma of mental illness and the loss that we suffer because of that. And I hope that we can do that. I think we're doing that in opening up the series on the state hospital, and on other mental health issues. And I commend the chair for being willing to open up these doors. And I think the more we talk about this, the more likely we are to deal with the stigma and the losses of those who are mentally ill.
Okay. Thank you very much, Representative Tomei, for your comments. Thanks to the department. Thanks for the folks from Peace Health coming up. I appreciate everybody bearing with us for a long week of hearings on the state hospital. But it's something that's long overdue, and so we're trying to compress a lot of information in a short period of time. But it's important to all of us, so thank you to each and every one of you who participated. With that, we'll adjourn the meeting. Have a nice weekend.